is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I want to talk about deprogramming America. Let me back up a little bit. Back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, I mean, it's still going on, but in fact, probably its most visible manifestation now is Scientology. But there were all these cults in the United States. You had the Maharaji, who was the 14-year-old perfect master, who, you know, essentially said he was like Jesus. A friend of mine was in his cult. In fact, my friend got kidnapped out of that cult and deprogrammed by Ted Patrick. And then went to work with Ted Patrick to deprogram others. You had the Moonies. You had Reverend Moon, who explicitly said that he was the reincarnation of Jesus. And all these Mooney followers. So you had these cults. Now, these were relatively benign cults in that they took kids away from their families. They isolated people, but they didn't lead to death. I mean, the most extreme example of that was Jim Jones. Jim Jones had a cult that was actually a death cult. He moved down to Guyana, and, you know, they all drank the Kool-Aid, literally, and died. Nations can be seized by cults, just like religions can be seized by cults. I lived in Germany in 86 and 87, and if you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Scherer, or other books, I mean, I was there. I not during the World War II, obviously, but you know, living in Germany, I knew some old Nazis, literally people who had been in Hitler's army, or who were. In fact, I knew one guy who was still a Nazi. He's now dead, but he's an old guy from that era. And what happened in Germany and happened in Japan, and we can find modern-day parallels to this with Slobodan Milosevic and Radovan Karadžić and is it Bosnia or Serbia? I mix up that part of the world. And frankly, ISIL, ISIS right now. And in fact, I would say, you know, Wahhabism in general. What you find are these basically death cults. They are cults every bit as much as the Maharajis or Reverend Moon's is a cult. But they're cults that involve the subjection or murder, or usually both, of, quote, inferior people. We played with this in the United States in two big ways. Most recently, against people of all races in the 1920s with the euthanasia movement, where we were sterilizing women who were mentally retarded and people who were born with birth defects. We were sterilizing them. Our eugenics movement, well, the eugenics movement actually began in England. It came out of Herbert Spencer, Charles Darwin's cousin, who was an economist, and a few other people, and came to the United States. And we did it big time. And Hitler actually used our eugenics posters about, you know, cleansing the race, essentially, in his early campaigns in the early 1930s. So throughout the 1930s and right up toward the end of the World War II, in Germany, you had Germans who actually believed that Hitler was somehow associated with Jesus, that he might be John the Baptist, he might be the reincarnation of Jesus, and Hitler himself was saying he was bringing a thousand-year Reich. Ein Volk, ein Welt, ein Reich, ein Führer. You know, one world, one people, one leader. Similarly, and you had German soldiers, you know, enthusiastically, not just going off to die, but also killing people. From Auschwitz to Belsen to Dachau, although Dachau was technically a work camp, not a death camp, but a lot of people died there. I think Dachau, if you want to draw parallels, would be probably more similar to American plantations. It was a slave labor camp. And they were all over Germany, by the way. There were hundreds of them. And they were manufacturing commercial goods. So you had a death cult in Germany. In Japan, you had a death cult. Emperor worship. You know, when Admiral Perry first broke Japan open to the world in the late 19th century, as I recall, with his black ships arriving and just shocking the Japanese. The Japanese response to Perry literally forcing at gunpoint the Japanese to allow Americans and Europeans to come in and trade with them and interact with them was xenophobic nationalism and racism and emperor worship. The Japanese had always, to a certain extent, believed that the emperor was the reincarnation, or not the reincarnation, was the last, whoever was the emperor was the last in the long lineage that went back to the very first man. And the very first man was born from the sun god. So essentially, the emperor was like, you know, the descendant of Jesus Christ sort of thing, the descendant of the Son of God. If Jesus had had children and they had had children and they had had children and had passed down all these generations and the Pope was actually could claim a bloodline back to Jesus, that's how it was in Japan. And people were so committed to this man that they thought was divine that they were willing to commit suicide, the kamikaze pilots, all this kind of thing. This sort of death cult, Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic. Karadzic was a psychiatrist. He actually, and his job, his goal was to cleanse the Muslims from that part of what was originally Yugoslavia, as I recall. And he did it by setting up rape camps where they would bring in hundreds of thousands of Muslim women and have good Christian soldiers rape them repeatedly until they were impregnated. And the more blonde the soldiers, the better. Just Hitler was doing something very similar in many cases. These are death cults. You wake up out of a death cult when you realize that it was a death cult. Most people, you know, they get caught up in a cult. They don't even realize they're in a cult. It was losing World War II that woke up the Germans and woke up the Japanese to the death cult of Nazism and the death cult of emperor worship. It was losing the war, you know, it was losing the war in the former Yugoslavia that woke up many of the Serbs or the Bosnians. I forget which is which. Here in the United States, we had a death cult that was running an institution called slavery for several hundred years. We had concentration camps that we call plantations for several hundred years. That death cult is still alive and well in the South. And it's not just in the South, by the way. This is why up in Wisconsin, when Scott Walker said, oh, well, we're going to make welfare recipients pee in a cup before they get their welfare. Even though, you know, drug abuse among people on welfare is actually lower than any other, pretty much any other group. We're going to humiliate them. Why? Well, because, you know, and he mentioned Milwaukee, which has got a very large black population, because they're black people, of course. Racism and slavery are inextricably tied. Paul Krugman, on June 22nd, in his piece, Slavery's Long Shadow, he says, as recently as the 1980s, half of all Americans opposed interracial marriage. Think about that for a second. He said, race made Reaganism possible. And to this day, Southern whites overwhelmingly vote Republican to the tune of 85 to 90% in the Deep South. Then he looked at another paper that was done in 2001 by some relatively conservative economists, actually, titled, Why Doesn't the United States Have a European-Style Welfare State? Why, it turns out? Well, because most white people think that most welfare goes to black people. They're wrong, but they think that. And so there you go. He points out the 2012 Supreme Court, gave states the ability to block expanding Medicaid. Who'd turn such a thing down? 22 states, 80% of the population was in states that practiced slavery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Only one former member of the Confederacy has expanded Medicaid. Why? A history of slavery. So how do we deal with this cult? Welcome back. Don in Weston, Wisconsin, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Don, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a statement that I just want to make that our president, President Obama, made at one of his inaugurations. And the statement was, you and I as citizens can shape this United States. My question is, in reference to trade, in reference to living wages, et cetera, when did he stop believing that?
Well, I think he still believes it. I you know, with regard to trade, I honestly don't know why the president thinks that this is going to be his legacy. You know, whether he wants to, you know, grow up to be Bill Clinton and be a rich guy with a big foundation. You know, why get in bed with the billionaires and corporatists? Or whether, as has been suggested to me by now two members of the House Progressive Caucus in private, you know, not going on the air and saying it, but in private, whether it's just that Michael Froman, I believe his name is, the president's trade advisor, is, you know, is a weasel who's been lying to the president. I honestly don't know. But, you know, it's a good question. It's a good question. And I'm actually going to get into that a little later on in the program. So I'll save my rant on that for that, if you don't mind. Don, thanks for the call. Mike, watching Free Speech TV in Chicago. Hey, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. You wanted to talk about slavery in the South and the Civil War?
Well, I kind of wanted to talk about or address how the South is taught about the Civil War, or at least the title of it.
Right.
Because a lot of people that in the South address it as the War of Northern Aggression. And that tends to connotate a victim status.
Yeah. And I got a story to tell you about this. I grew up in Louise and I grew up in Michigan, and we learned that the Civil War is fought over slavery, right, which it was. We moved to Atlanta, Georgia in 1983, and our kids were all elementary school age, and I think our oldest was in junior high school. And I remember when one of our kids, I think it was our son, came home from school, you know, after the first year of during his first year of school in the Atlanta public school system, or in the, actually it's Marietta, Georgia. This was Newt Gingrich's district. It's the white suburb just north of Atlanta. And he came home and made reference to the War of Northern Aggression. And I said, what's the War of Northern Aggression? I'd never heard the phrase. You know, I was in my late 20s, and I'd never heard the phrase. And he said, well, you know, they call it the Civil War, but it's the War of Northern Aggression. And I said, that's what you learned in school today? Yeah. So back to you, Mike.
Well, that's kind of what the whole victimhood thing, that's something I've realized that the Republican Party tends to glom onto. Love to use that as victimhood. And I think that probably explains why there's so many Republican voters in the South, because they were kind of like taught this whole victimhood. What I don't, and maybe you or your listeners might know, I don't know of any war in recent history from maybe the 19th, 20th, and 21st century that was started by someone who actually won it. It seems like anyone who started the war has lost it. And I think that's something that should be a lesson that needs to be taught and addressed to the education system in the South.
Yeah, and by the way, the flag of the Confederacy is the white flag. That's the flag that they were flying at the end of the Civil War, was the white flag. So if you want to put up a flag of the Confederate States of America, put up a white flag. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. Okay, as Paul Krugman was saying, the history of slavery, I'm quoting Paul Krugman, is a strong predictor of everything from gun control, or rather its absence, to low minimum wages, to hostility to unions, to tax policy. That's it. He says 80% of the population in Medicaid-refusing America lives in states that practiced slavery before the Civil War. Only one former member of the Confederacy has expanded Medicaid. On top of that, you know, this death cult has – the reason that this death cult has been alive and well in the United States is because after the South lost the Civil War and slavery, quote, ended, there was about a 10-year period called Reconstruction where actually African Americans were elected to public office. I think they took a majority of the political offices in South Carolina, where they were a majority of the population. They took significant political offices across Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama. And then Rutherford B. Hayes, in order to get elected president, made a deal with the South which was occupied by the Northern Army, right? The ability of blacks to vote in the South, the ability of African Americans to vote in the South was being enforced literally by the presence of Union troops. And Hayes's deal to become president was that he would withdraw those Union troops if he would just be made president. And he was, and he did. And that was the end of Reconstruction. Immediately, the South said, okay, we can't have them as slaves anymore, but we're going to have them as cheap labor. And the South has been the cheap labor South ever since. And all the stuff that goes with it. It's a cult that suggests that some humans are of greater value than others, some are less of lesser value than others, based solely on the amount of pigment in their skin, of melanin in their skin. This is insane. I mean, you got like Congressman Steve Scalise, the third most powerful Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's the House Whip. He's the Republican Party's whip. He works under Kevin McCarthy and John Boehner. He ran against David Duke down in Louisiana, and what he said was the novel, and I'm quoting. He said he embraces many of the same conservative views as David Duke, but is far more viable. That's not a quote. Here's the exact quote. The novelty of David Duke has worn off. The voters in this district are smart enough to realize that they need to get behind someone who not only believes in the issues they care about, in other words, the David Duke issues, but can also get elected. Duke has proven that he can't get elected, and that's the first and most important thing. In other words, vote for me. I'm not identified as a crazy, although I still believe all this stuff. This is the third most powerful Republican in the House of Representatives. This is the Southern strategy on steroids. This is how the Republicans took the South. So, and now we see, you know, days after this over at the Daily Beast, Kate Bricolet, days after the massacre at a black church in South Carolina, KKK flyers are showing up with candy on people's front lawns. Included a phone number for the loyal white knights of the Ku Klux Klan, along with peppermint and Tootsie Rolls. They were distributed under cover of darkness, of course, in California, Kansas, Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. A message on this hotline that you call, which is based in North Carolina, salutes Dylann Roof because he said he wanted to start a race war. It says, we in the loyal white knights of the KKK would like to say hail victory to Dylann S. Roof, who decided to do what the Bible told him to do. An eye for an eye, a tooth for the tooth. They, black people, have spilled our blood too long. It's about time someone spilled theirs. If it ain't white, it ain't right. White power. That's the message you get if you call this 800 number. So what's the deal here? This cult is based on religious nationalism or a romantic nationalism. The best example of it is Gone with the Wind. And there's a great op-ed over at by Johnny Price, a folklorist, over at Huffington Post. And he says, okay, let's take on these revisionist talking points. There's this lost cause narrative that the Civil War was a romantic struggle for freedom against an oppressive government trying to force cultural change. So the people in the apologists for the modern day, like the Stars and Bars, would say, well, the Civil War was about the economics of slavery. Excuse me, the Civil War was about economics, not slavery. Well, no, the Civil War was actually about the economics of slavery. They'll say the Civil War was about states' rights, not slavery. Well, yeah, the Civil War was about the states' right to maintain slavery. They say that's not the Confederate flag. True, it's a battle flag. It's a banner under which men fought and died to enact secession and defend slavery. Then they say heritage is not hate. And he says, this is a funny story. The heritage is hate. Yes, Senator, it does represent one side of the Civil War. That side, he's talking back to Lindsey Graham, that side that advocated slavery and secession, it's a flag of treason. Mike Huckabee gave a speech to this group. They've killed more people. These folks have killed more people in the United States, these, you know, conservative citizens, than Al-Qaeda has since 9/11. So how do we break the hold of this cult? The way they did it in Germany, the way they did it in the former Yugoslavia, the way they did it in Japan, the way they did it in Rwanda after the genocide in Rwanda, which again was a death cult. It was led by talk radio show hosts, by the way. The way you break people out of these cults is by awakening them to the dysfunctional and destructive and false, lying narrative of the cult itself. And that's what I hope to be doing today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
This is an extraordinary moment in America. We are finally having the conversation we should have had in 1880. Let's continue it. Twenty-eight minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking about these death cults, this specifically the death cult that is referred to very often by white people as Southern Pride. The reason why it's so easy to get people to go along with one of these cults, whether it was Nazism or emperor worship or ethnic cleansing, in Rwanda or in Yugoslavia or whatever, the reason it's, or, you know, Mao's Great Leap Forward or Pol Pot's killing 2 million Cambodians, the reason it's so, it is possible to get people to go along with this is because there is a basic human instinct to say, me and mine first, right? If somebody in your family is attacked, you react very differently than somebody you don't know. And so there's this natural, and then, you know, we go from family to clan, to tribe, to state, to nation, right? Essentially, I mean, you know, there's an anthropological organization here. And what Hitler did so brilliantly, and Hirohito did so brilliantly, and on it goes. I mean, the same death cult was run in South Africa and Rhodesia under Ian Smith and W.P. Botha. What they did so brilliantly is they said, we are us and they are them, and we are better than them, and therefore they should be doing, you know, they should be the slaves, essentially. And that mentality continues to exist in the United States. Here is Bill Doris. So this was from Nashville Public Radio. This is the guy on whose property is a statue of the founder of the KKK along Highway 65, just as you're driving into Nashville. And here's what he had to say about slavery. This is the, you know, one of the modern spokesmen for this slice of the Republican electorate in the South. Here he is.
Slavery was the first form of Social Security. Stop and think about it a minute. It was a cradle to the grave proposition. They never had it so good as far as job security to begin with. It wasn't the best of job security, but it had benefits.
So, you know, when slavery got outlawed, what did they do in the South? They started passing all kinds of laws that pretty much any black person could easily break. Like, you can't go on this street, or you can't look at these people, or you can't speak out this way, or, you know, anti-profanity laws, all kinds of things. So that, and the modern day version of these, by the way, is the war on drugs. This is, I mean, Nixon brought this forward too. It was just a new form of Jim Crow. And Reagan put it on steroids. If you look at the number of people arrested in the war on drugs, particularly people of color, it explodes after 1981. But the whole thing was arrest them and then put them in work camps. And most of your southern prisons throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries were work camps. Slave labor. And we're right back to slave labor. And, as recently as the 1980s, as Paul Krugman points out, half of Americans said interracial marriage is wrong. That would be presumably white Americans. In other words, this mentality that there's something profoundly different between white people and black people other than just the amount of pigment in their skin was not just alive and well, but was, you know, the pervading meme. So the question, how do we get rid of these death cults? How did the Germans wake up from the death cult of Nazism? How does the occasional person wake up from the these various religious cults that are so destructive? I mean, I'm sure some of the people at Jim Jones's Jonestown in the last minutes realized that they made a mistake, that they were part of a death cult. How is it that the Japanese woke up? My dad was in Japan for 2 years after the end of World War II, and we had a lot of conversations about this. And many of the Japanese were still the emperor is the incarnation of God. There's still a lot of emperor worship that goes on in Japan, and it's sort of their version of our problem with people who still think, you know, slavery was a good thing. And the South wanting to have low wages and no unions and all this kind of stuff. And here's Bill O'Reilly saying, no, no, that's all in the past. Here he is.
Every country on the planet has racist elements within it.
But what does that have to do with anything?
It has to do with anything. You can't have a perfect world, Kirsten.
But it doesn't mean... Well, you're making two different arguments. I mean, is it we're racist and so is everybody else?
No, no, we're not racist.
Everybody else is racist, but we're not racist.
We don't have a system where racism is acceptable at all. We don't.
Well, no, it's not
right,
acceptable. But
right. And that's why in the late 1970s, they passed a law to outlaw redlining by banks, because banks were still doing it. And you know, we may no longer have de jure, you know, by at law racism, but de facto, it's alive and well. Here's Monica Crowley on Fox, suggesting that there's no institutional racism.
Are there individual racists in this country?
Of course.
Sadly, yes. Does institutional racism exist anymore? No, it does not.
Yes, it does. And it's called the Southern Strategy of the Republican Party. This is not to say that all Republicans are racist, but not by a long shot. The Republican Party, just like the Democratic Party, is a coalition of a whole bunch of different groups. You've got some Republicans who are just Republicans because they want to outlaw abortion. You've got some Republicans who are just Republicans because they want to own 35 guns and they think that the Democrats are opposed to that. You got some Republicans who are just Republicans because they're rich and they know that the real agenda of the Republican Party is supporting the rich people. But there are a number of people, particularly in the South, and as Paul Krugman points out, this is why the South has been won over and over and over again for, you know, basically since Reagan has gone solidly Republican, who are white racists. And, you know, Bill O'Reilly essentially says, so what? Here, clip number four.
The issue that I made a noise about that upset you so much is this idea that there's something crazy about talking about the fact that slavery was part of this country's history. That there are people out there that believe this, that we believe this. This is what happened.
So what?
Yeah, so what? Right. And then this is O'Reilly going off on it's only the lunatic fringe, you know. Here it is.
Everybody does not acknowledge that.
Well, then you're talking about the lunatic fringe.
No, it's not the lunatic fringe. There are actually a lot of people in this country who are racist, and you just refuse. I have to wonder why you can't see
what's happening, because most Americans are not racist.
Really? So how many black friends do you have?
Really?
How many black friends do you have?
If you think most Americans are racist, I'm ashamed of you.
I'm asking you a serious question.
I'm ashamed of you.
First of all, I didn't say most Americans were racist.
You just said it.
Well, if I said that I meant that we have racism in this country.
Every country has it.
What? How would that make it okay?
It's not okay. It's not endemic.
But I don't understand how that's an answer. Like, that every country has it?
You can't run public policy because there are fringe elements who are insane.
Right. So let's say if there's a fringe element that's insane, we're not going to do anything about them at all. ISIS. If there's a fringe element that's insane, we can't make public policy around that. Al-Qaeda. If there are fringe elements that are insane, we can't do anything about that. The Weather Underground. What'd she say? Oh, yeah. Voter fraud. Right. Yeah, no, we don't do public policy around this stuff. And meanwhile, over on Fox, a Fox News or a Fox radio guy, a full-fledged cultural cleansing of the southern states is underway as lawmakers debate whether to remove Confederate flags and rename schools and parks that were originally named after Confederate war heroes. See, this is actually what needs to happen, is we need to acknowledge who these people actually were. The guy that this statue in Nashville, Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, there's this giant, you know, 20, 30-foot statue to him on I-65 in Nashville that was made by James Earl Ray's lawyer, Jack Kershaw. This guy was not only a traitor to the United States, he was a war criminal. When a black brigade of Union soldiers surrendered to his army, instead of taking them as prisoners of war, he ordered them all slaughtered. The guy was a war criminal and a traitor. And we've got statues to him in state capitals. See, I think that we are at this moment where we are finally, and you know, thank God, we are finally beginning to look at and reconcile our own history. We are beginning the process of deprogramming ourselves, which arguably began in 1865 and came to a screeching halt in the 1870s when Rutherford B. Hayes said, okay, you make me president, I'll take the Northern troops out of the South, and we will end Reconstruction. And it flipped immediately into Jim Crow, and we were an apartheid state from the 1870s right up until today, frankly. But by law, right up until 15, 20 years ago. So how do you deprogram? Well, you know, as I said, defeating in battle is one way when it's an entire nation. And we defeated the South in battle. And that deprogramming began. And the South, and as I said, African-Americans actually got elected to public office in the South in the 10 years after the end of the Civil War. But then Reconstruction ended. It takes a couple of generations for deprogramming to happen when it's happening at a national level. It took a couple of generations for Germans to look back and say, you know what, my father did was reprehensible. What my grandfather did was reprehensible. For many Germans, they basically had to wait until their grandfather who fought in Hitler's army was dead to say that was reprehensible. It takes time. But it takes awareness, and that's what we're doing now. It's a good thing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And once again, you want to fly the flag of the Confederacy? Cool. The Confederacy lost the Civil War. Their flag is a white flag. Fly it. Welcome back. Raul in Corpus Christi, Texas. Hey, Raul, what's up?
Hi. Tom, what's up, man? I'm a big fan of you.
Thank you.
I got DirecTV a couple months ago because of the NFL. So I found you, and I wanted to make a statement about something, what I watch on YouTube called Koch Brothers Exposed. Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had the people who put that together on the program.
Yeah, Greenwald, right?
Yeah, Robert Greenwald.
Brave New Film.
Brave New Films.
They pointed out in 2009 that the Koch brothers were funding Republican Party to resegregate, white children, and then to, like turn it back to the back to the 60s in a way.
Yeah.
And that was in 2009, and that was just like a couple of years ago. And what I don't understand is like nobody hasn't brought it up, and how nobody brought it up in North Carolina, how the same kid was from North Carolina. You know what I mean? Like, I could see what you say. Like, they express that philosophy, and then you have a 21-year-old like him, you know, a loser in a way, you know, take it by heart and accept that Republican philosophy.
Yeah, well, it's the losers who buy into the cults because they've got nothing else. And the cult peddles victimhood to them, which is something that, you know, Fox so-called news and right-wing hate radio are really, really good at. And, you're the victim. You're the victim of these black people or whatever it may be. And
I'm a Tijano, so I could see, the racism still exists.
Oh, but it's, in 1954, when Brown v. Board of Education ordered the integration of schools, was it Virginia or South Carolina? One of those two states closed every public school in the state. And all these private schools sprang up, both white and black, but they were totally segregated because they were private schools. And I would submit to you that a piece, not all, obviously, but a piece of the school voucher movement is really a group of white people who want to make sure that there's no black kids in their schools.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
It's, this stuff is alive and well. Raul, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for calling and for watching on Free Speech TV. Claude in Hempstead, North Carolina. Hey, Claude, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I wanted to call about the flag business.
Yeah.
How would people in this country and people in Europe feel if the defeated Germans incorporated the swastika into their new flag?
Right.
Or if they put up statues to the
to Hitler
all over the country.
Yeah, or to SS generals.
They were defeated, and that stuff was outlawed. Why the hell wasn't that done in this country?
Well, there was, that's a good question. And I would say that it was, you know, Hayes's compromise. It was the end of Reconstruction that, that led to the end of that. I mean, we, the roots of slavery and racism are very, very deep. They go back to the founding of our republic. In fact, I would argue that they even go back before that. The genocide of Native Americans began before the slave trade began in North America and by Europeans. And so, you know, we're steeped in kind of a dual racist, two racist narratives. And but yeah, I think that that's sort of what's happening right now, as you know, Walmart saying no more flags and Amazon's taking them down. I mean, there's a certain point, eBay, good luck with that. I mean, I think they have Nazi memorabilia on there. I could be wrong. But, you know, it's going to take some time. But we all have a role to play in it. Claude, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Keith in Waldorf, Maryland. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First time caller, liked your show for a long time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I just have a quick point about how to deprogram people, and it's really simple, and it's just dialogue, because part of the problem in the South is when you hear the same thing over and over and over again, it's not just necessarily the South, it's rural America, and you're surrounded by everyone who thinks like you, everyone who looks like you. You hear the same thing over and over again, and you don't have a counterpoint of saying, wait a minute, I know a black person. I know they're not like this. I know a gay person. They're not like this. I know someone who's different. They're not like this. So you get the same. So the only way to deprogram people is just have that counterbalance.
Right.
That, you know, you hear the same thing, but it's like, wait a minute. No. I know.
Well, I think you also have to deconstruct the symbology, like our previous caller who said, you know, if the Germans had incorporated the swastika into the new flag, you know, would we have been okay with that? Or for that matter, would the average German have been okay with that? And the answer is no, because they realized what a horror that flag represented. And I think there was
I've been in Germany before, and then they don't accept that. Anything with Nazism is not accepted.
Yeah, it's not just not accepted.
Society,
it's illegal.
They decided to, do a reconciliation and say, hey, we're going to learn from our mistake and never let this happen again.
Right.
And one thing about the United States is we don't learn from our mistakes. They keep happening over.
Well, no, I think we do learn from our mistakes. Women can vote. African Americans have been enfranchised. It's just, you know, we started out in such a weird place, you know, where basically, you know, white men who owned property were the only ones who could vote. And they were, this was for whom the Constitution was written, et cetera, et cetera. We started out in such a weird place that we've actually come a long way, I think. But,
you know, I agree with you.
Yeah. But now it is time to say, okay, the symbols of racism and slavery, you can keep them if you want. But instead of labeling them as brave and noble, let's label them as losers and traitors. And, you know,
absolutely.
It's just very straightforward. Keith, thank you for the call. This is the process of waking up from these death cults. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah. You know how you were, how to get rid of the death cult?
How's that?
Is to get rid of Fox News.
Well, good luck with
Fox
that.
News.
It's got a billionaire behind it.
We're going to have to try to deprogram the people who watch Fox News, because that's all they watch.
Yeah.
Fox News is constantly telling them they're the victim. They, the white people, are the victim.
Who
do they lionize? They bring the George Zimmermans or the Cliven Bundys or the Duck Dynasty guy.
Yep. Yep.
And so the people in this cult, they are watching Fox News. And it is like a cult because that's all they watch.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't disagree, Anita. I think that Fox News is a toxic, propaganda source for the Republican Party in the United States, and the part of the Republican Party has been since the 1960s reaching out aggressively to white racists in the South. That's the bad news. Anita, thank you for the call. The good news is that fraction of white racists, even in the South, is slowly diminishing over time, and I think that we're hitting I think we're frankly at a tipping point. We'll see. Jim in Lockport, Illinois, you're about to make a point that I've been making for some long time here now about, you know, how FDR would have handled this by making the government the employer of last resort. Go for it.
Oh, you betcha. I think the big problem is jobs. We get out there, if the Republicans were out there and working and passing bills to strengthen our infrastructure, like Bernie said, $1 trillion, 13 million jobs.
Right.
This kid may have been working instead of shooting up the place.
Yeah, I agree. And he's not a kid. He's 21 years old, and he's a murderer and a terrorist, and he was unemployed. And had he had a good job, a decent job, particularly a job in an integrated factory, you know, his life may have turned out very, very, very differently. And so, Stuart in St. Petersburg, Florida, you want to disagree with me? Really?
To a point, no. Okay, I think that the flag should come down. And I'm from the South, and I've had family members who probably fought in the war. But you have to look at your thinking, and to call them traitors or terrorists is obscured, because if we didn't fought England like we did, we would not have the country we have today. So I guess all our founders
were labeled traitors and terrorists, Stuart. When they signed the Declaration of Independence, what did Ben Franklin say?
I know what he said.
He said we must hang together, because if we don't, we shall surely hang separately. They knew that they were traitors, and King George constantly referred to them as terrorists because they George Washington's armies refused to march in line the way the British soldiers did, and it was a hell of a lot harder to kill them. Instead, they were doing guerrilla war tactics. They were not traitors to their own country. These were people who had been in North America for 2, 3, 4, 5 generations. They thought of North America as their country and England as the distant oppressor. That's a completely different thing from the slaveholders in the South who had willingly become part of the United States of America, and they became traitors to the United States of America. And Dylan Storm Roof, this 21-year-old terrorist, thug, murderer, he is as much a traitor and a terrorist as we have ever had in this country.
But guess what? Now, what do you want this kid, this young man, to go to? You want him to go to a hospital because they're going to probably find him sick and go, well...
It doesn't matter. I want him to serve life in prison, which is what anybody who commits a crime like this should do. But that said, mostly what I want to come out of this is for people to realize that there is an entire institution which is aligned aggressively and heavily with interlaced with the Republican Party in the United States, particularly in the South, that promotes and believes the same things that this kid believed, terrorist believed that led him to murder these nine people, these nine decent people.
That is ludicrous. You know why? Because you go up north, there's as much racism up there, and you never mention the north.
I did mention the north, actually. In fact, I started out by saying Scott Walker saying that welfare recipients, you know, particularly in Milwaukee, which has got a large black population, have to pee in a cup in order to get their welfare benefits. And all the white people applauded, you know, because everybody knew the kind of code that he was talking in. The Republican Party still speaks in this code, Stuart. This is what Lee Atwater said. He said, you know, we don't use the N-word anymore. We don't even have to talk about busing anymore. All we have to talk about is welfare and cutting welfare programs and cutting spending, and everybody gets it. That's going to hurt black people more than whites. And that will reach out to our base. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, in addition to this whole issue of race and racism, excuse me, and the treason that was committed by much of the South back 150 years ago, more or less, and how it continues, how that death cult that sanctioned slavery and to this day thinks probably, you know, if we went back to slavery, it'd be a good thing. And some of them are willing to say it out loud, like Bill Doris did on National Public Radio. Play that clip if you got it, Shano. This is the guy who's proudly got the statue right along the freeway of the founder of the KKK and the war criminal from the Civil War on his property. Here's what he had to say.
Slavery was the first form of Social Security. Stop and think about it a minute. It was a cradle to the grave proposition. They never had it so good as far as job security to begin with. It wasn't the best of job security, but it had benefits.
Right, right. See, not only is that alive and well, but it needs to be challenged, and it is being challenged, and I think that we're having a national moment. It's interesting to watch the troglodytes over at Fox so-called News, trying to pretend that none of this is really going on and everything's fine and it's really not about racism and we don't have a problem with right-wing killers. Actually, more people have been killed by conservative fundamentalists, by conservative terrorists. And I think we really need to stop calling them right-wing terrorists and start calling them conservative terrorists. I mean, the group that radicalized Dylan Storm Roof, the group was called the Council of Conservative Citizens. These conservative terrorists have killed more Americans in more attacks than have any Muslims since 9/11. You take that one off, Bin Laden got lucky of 9/11 out of the equation, and conservative terrorists throughout the history of the United States have been the main source of terror within the United States. I mean, for 150 years in the South, for 150, if you include, post-Reconstruction, for 150 years in the South, and to this day, in many ways, they practice terrorism. I mean, this was an act of terrorism in this church. So in addition to that, there are other things happening in the world that I want to talk with you about. Interesting piece over at TPM. It's an Associated Press story. And it talks about how there are two pieces to fast track, essentially. There have always been two pieces to fast track. Because everybody in Congress knows that whenever we pass a so-called trade deal, more Americans are going to lose their jobs. So to try and sweeten the pot, Richard Nixon did this. Bill Clinton did this. George W. Bush did this. And now Barack Obama is going to do this. To sweeten the pot, they add, along with the fast track, along with the legislation to move these so-called trade bills through. Our tariffs are almost zero right now. I mean, it's not like we've got impediments to trade. These are new rules for the road, right? These are things that will increase the profits of the big pharma industry. They'll increase the profits of big tobacco. They'll increase the profits of the chemical industry, particularly that part of the chemical industry that's associated with our food supply, the GMOs and the pesticides. It's going to increase the profits of all, this is really about locking down the world economy on behalf of transnational corporations. But along with this, they've always passed something that they call, what they're calling right now, trade adjustment assistance. It's gone by other names in the past, but basically what it is, in this case, is $700 million to send people who lose their jobs to Vietnam as a result of TPP, to pay for those people to go to school. Now, it's a scam. It was a scam when Clinton did it. It was a scam when Nixon did it. It was a scam when Bush did it. It's a scam. It was a scam when Reagan did it. It's a scam now. Because most of that money ends up in the hands of private for-profits, colleges or trade schools, really, that are created exclusively to be available to take these federal dollars, these $700 million federal dollars, and make so somebody can make a buck off it, which is one of the reasons that Republicans historically have gone along with it. And Democrats go along with it because just the idea of workers being thrown out of their jobs with nothing to fall back on, makes Democrats cringe. With the exception of the 13 who betrayed us and voted in the Senate yesterday for fast track. And there's going to be another vote today. As far as I can tell, it hasn't happened yet. But the final vote on fast track, it'll probably be at the end of the day, at the end of the news cycle, so that they can, get it, the very last thing, get it done, get it off to the president. Nobody's paying attention. People are talking about, the Reverend Pinckney and his funeral is going to be on Friday and along with the other eight people who were killed with him and all these kind of things. But the talk is the president has said he won't sign fast track unless there's this $700 million to help out people who get screwed by free trade in America. This Trade Adjustment Authority, TAA. He says he won't sign TPP, Fast Track, without TAA. Help out the workers. And what the Senate just passed does not have TAA in it. So Mitch McConnell has said he's going to attach that to a bill for African trade that's not controversial, and it will pass today or tomorrow, and that's going to satisfy the president. But see, then it has to go back to the House. Republicans, by and large, absolutely oppose TAA. They do not, you know, what, $700 million to help workers? To hell with them. That's the Republican attitude. Republicans are all about billionaires. I mean, you know, as you know, within the Republican Party, there are the billionaires and the big corporations. There are the paid shills for the billionaires and the paid corporations. And there are the dupes, the people who are duped into following them because they they got whistled, they got dog whistled about guns or gays or God or race. So Sander Levin is a member of the House of Representatives. He says he thinks a lot of the Democrats are going to support this, but there are people in the House, and I'm guessing Alan Grayson. In fact, we should get Congressman Grayson on tomorrow if we possibly can to talk about this, or Congressman DeFazio, Peter DeFazio. I don't know what their position is going to be, but there is talk that the Democrats in the House are going to blow up the TAA. They're not going to give this to the president. So then the question is, will the president sign Fast Track without the Trade Adjustment Authority, without the let's help out the displaced workers? And I'm inclined to believe that he will, because he wants these trade deals to go through. And you know, considers this part of his legacy. It's not going to be his legacy for the American worker. It's going to be his legacy for the billionaire class. Just like NAFTA was Bill Clinton's legacy for the billionaire class. And what does the billionaire class do now? They pay him $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 every time he shows up. He's collected $2 billion for his charity. Obama could be in the same position 5 years, 10 years from now. Sweet. Or, you know, maybe Michael Froman is simply lying to Obama and he doesn't realize how bad this trade deal is going to be for the average American worker. Not to mention people in other countries where they still manufacture generic drugs like India, which is not part of TPP, but that's coming. So anyhow, this is going to get interesting. The time is not yet to say, okay, we've been beat. And even if TPP gets signed, the Fast Track gets signed, there's still the treaty coming down the road, the TPP.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we can fight that in the House and the Senate, too. So a lot on our plate. We'll be picking up your calls after the break. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Corky, watching Free Speech TV in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I called to tell you, they're built.
Click. We just lost you, Corky. Okay, let's try Dave watching Free Speech TV in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Corky, just give us a call back. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the TPP and basically all these trade agreements, and you had identified them as agreements. I would have to say I see them as more arrangements between the corporate elites of all the countries involved, and basically they view everything as a commodity, and especially people.
Yes.
They're looking for the cheapest labor, the lowest tax rates, the less stringent environmental laws. And in my view, I think that the environmental, you know, consequences of this are going to be the worst of anything out of this. You know, it was pointed out, Naomi Klein pointed out in her book how the free trade that goes on, capitalism and the environment are so intertwined, and I think she pointed, you know,
as did the Pope, by the way.
What's that?
As did the Pope.
Yes. Oh, and it's encyclical. Yeah, and you know, to me, that's the biggest thing right now. I know people don't see it that way, but you know, they're so they go together so, you know, so much that, hello?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm listening. Oh. Yeah, no, I agree. I think that these are, they're not agreements. They're actually, I think that they're treaties and they should require 2/3 vote of the Senate. Richard Nixon figured out a way to get around that, which was the whole fast-track thing and calling them agreements rather than treaties and setting up arbitration rather than a judicial system. But these are the narrowest of nibbling around the edges of legality that I think are frankly just totally wrong. But, yeah, I'm with you. Well said, Dave. Thank you for the call.
What?
I'm sorry, Dave. I hit the button just as you said that word. I didn't realize you had more to say. Jill in Princeton, Minnesota. Hey, Jill. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm listening. I'm following. And I need everything you say. However, as much as we need the conversation, we need one more thing, that is the political revolution.
Yep.
That's joining everybody. We need to talk more about joining all of these issues.
Right.
For the one common need of not just the middle class. We need to shape up the oligarchs.
Yeah.
You know, get them back into a reality where they see that human beings are worthy.
Yeah. That people are people, and that we're all just humans here.
Yeah, and we have one voice. Right now, Jill Stein is great. I love her. But we have a voice. Bernie isn't our savior. He's there for us.
Right. He's our spokesperson. Bernie is a statesman and a leader. And they're very, very rare. Jill, thank you for the call. I'm with you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's very interesting to me this morning, as speaking of trade, how quickly we forget. You know, it's 1992, in the presidential debates in 1992. Let me know when you're ready, Jim. Oh, he's got it? Okay, cool. In 1992, you had George Herbert Walker Bush running for re-election versus Bill Clinton running on the Democratic side for election. And then there was this third guy, this weird guy with big ears, this cranky billionaire from Texas by the name of Ross Perot, who decided to jump into the race. He created his own political party and jumped into the race in this party that he himself bought and paid for. And his one issue was no to free trade. We need managed trade. We need regulated trade. We need trade that works to the advantage of Americans rather than the rest of the world. That's the kind of trade we need. That's what Ross Perot said. He won almost 20% of the vote in 1992 for president. So I was fascinated this morning when on the Mika Brzezinski show, I heard that, and I think this was just in New York State. I could be wrong. Or maybe it was in New Hampshire. It was one of the states. There was just a new poll that was done. And Jeb Bush was number one. Number two was Donald Trump with 11% of the Republican vote. And they were sitting there going, how can it be? How can Donald Trump get 11% of the vote? And the theory that was being floated by the pundits on the program where it was, oh, well, he's an outsider and people are fond of outsiders. You know, kind of this is a populist moment. I don't think so. I think the reason that Donald Trump has gone to 11%, and one of the reasons why Bernie Sanders is just climbing in the polls, is because of his position on trade. Here's Donald Trump on trade.
to try and help lift up the middle class in ways that has not been accomplished before, specifically.
The biggest thing we have to do is new trade agreements. China is killing us. Mexico is killing us. Japan is killing us. Everybody is beating us. We have incompetent people negotiating trade. We are losing money at every single step. We don't make good deals anymore.
Give us an example.
And that's why, Joe, I go out to speak. And I think Mark will tell you, although he's only about 70% there, but I think you will say, I get the biggest crowds, I get the biggest ovations, I'm getting very good poll numbers, and nobody until yesterday thought I was running. I mean, it's fun.
Well, actually, that's what we said yesterday, but give us an example of how, because a lot of people believe it right now, especially while we're negotiating the latest trade deal, that the United States always is out negotiated on trade deals. Give me a good specific example of that.
Well, because China and all of these people, Mexico is the new China, by the way. Mexico is unbelievable what they're doing with cars and with industry. They are taking our business like we're a bunch of babies. We don't have our best and our brightest negotiating force. We have a bunch of losers. We have a bunch of political hacks. We have diplomats. And China puts the people, I know the smartest guys on Wall Street. I know our best negotiators. I know the overrated guys, the underrated guys, the guys that nobody ever heard of that are killers, that are great. We got to use those people.
See, even Democrats can watch that and go, huh, maybe I could vote for that guy. I mean, until they hear his other crazy positions. But I think that this is a moment. This is a populist moment. A Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders moment, for lack of a better phrase. It happens every 80 years in America, that we have basically a political reboot, and it's typically the consequence of an economic crisis. This last one being the crash of 2008, and everybody knows that it ain't over yet. I mean, they may not believe the title of my book, The Crash of 2016, but they know it ain't over yet. And 80 years before that, it was the crash of 1929, and that led to FDR. 80 years before that, it was the crash of 1857, which led right to the Civil War. 80 years before that, it was the great crash of 1770, which led to the Tea Act. I mean, this is a crash that affected England as well as us, mostly England, in fact, led to the Tea Act, which led to the Boston Tea Party, which was the beginning of the open rebellion in the United States. These were all incredibly populist moments. So as, on the one hand, our nation is coming together across races increasingly, and we're starting to say no to the explicit symbols of savagery and you know, concentration camps, slavery, hatred, all that kind of stuff, on the one hand. On the other hand, or not on the other hand, but at the same time, America is realizing that, you know, we've basically, since the election of Reagan, been screwed. That every one of these trade deals has hurt us. We now have an $11 trillion trade deficit. That's $35,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And unlike our national debt, where we owe that money by and large to ourselves, our trade deficit is 100% owed to other countries. $11 trillion. $500 billion a year we add to it. We're adding over $1 billion a day, some days $2 billion, to our trade deficit. And every $1 billion is another few thousand jobs gone from the United States. So, this is a very interesting moment. And the question is, in my mind, is will the establishment get it? Will they wake up and start speaking to the people in an honest voice? Certainly with regard to trade, that's not what's coming out of this administration. Is that going to come out of the Clinton campaign? We'll see. I hope so. But it's certainly coming out of Bernie Sanders, and increasingly maybe, I don't know, Martin O'Malley, what's his name? Who's the, Lincoln Chafee, yeah, the former Republican. Not hearing much about him. You know, is it going to come out of them? I'm telling you, that Ross Perot moment is still alive and well in the United States. Any candidate who runs on ending these insane trade deals is going to have a really, really good shot whether it's Donald Trump in the Republican Party or whether it's Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party. And I hate to put those two together in the sentence because Donald Trump is nuts and Bernie Sanders is a statesman. But there you go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
That and anything goes summer. We'll be back with your calls after the news here at the bottom of the hour.
I have so got brains.
Well, why don't you use them?
Go!
I haven't got a brain.
Dumbest thing ever.
Because I haven't got a brain.
That's the dumbest thing I ever heard.
Oh, if I only had a brain.
It's our If I Only Had a Brain alert. So this guy thinks he's going to smuggle some pot through Newark Liberty Airport in New Jersey on Friday, last Friday. And I don't know if you remember, but when I was in Denver for a vocal board meeting, this was, I don't know, 5-6 months ago. In the hotel that we were at, in the conference room on the table, they had these little dishes of candy, and the candy was called Mary Jane. And now it was just kind of a peanut butter chocolate stuff, you know, chewy, sticky candy. But I thought, oh my God, you know, pot is legal here in Denver. Mary Jane candy? Are they, you know, well, it turns out Mary Jane candy's got nothing to do with pot. And I brought one back and I showed it to you on TV here. And I don't know where it is now, but the Mary Jane candy. Anyhow, so this guy decides he's going to hide his pot in candy wrappers. And he puts it in Mary Jane candy wrappers, which immediately caught the attention, apparently, of the security folks in New York. Not the smartest thing to do. On the other hand, you know, it's stupid that we have a law against this. Alabama's governor has said to has ordered the Confederate flag be lowered, taken down on the Alabama State House grounds. Good on him. See, step by step, I think that the awakening from the cult is happening, at least among those relatively high-profile people in the media or in politics. On the other hand, Ted Cruz is having a terrible problem. Two of his state co-chairs, State Senator Lee Bright, Cruz's South Carolina co-chair, has emerged as one of the most vocal opponents of taking down the flag. Right. We can't have that. He called it a Stalinist purge. He says, Bright, this is the co-chair of Ted Cruz's South Carolina campaign. He says, it's not just the flag. They want to take down the Confederate monuments. I've gotten emails from people who want to rename streets. Anytime you want to basically remove the symbols of history from a state, that's something that just is very bad. These are honorable men who fought for their homes, their home state. To disgrace them in the name of public correctness is just wrong. They're not here to defend themselves. No, they're not here to defend themselves. They lost. They committed treason against the United States of America. They're traitors. And they fought on behalf of slavery, owning and torturing other human beings, running concentration camps that they euphemistically called plantations. That's the Southern heritage, right? I mean, you know, there's lots of parts of Southern heritage that I suppose are really, you know, sipping mint juleps on the porch or, you know, being nice to each other. I was, you know, really struck when we first moved to Atlanta back in 1983 by Southern hospitality, how nice people in the South were. I mean, it was such a contrast to living in the North, to being in New York City. I hadn't lived there, but, you know, even in New Hampshire. But, you know, it's easy to be hospitable when those people are in their place and you're just talking white people to white people. Anyhow, anything goes summer. Back to your calls. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's up? Dave, can you hear me? You are on the air. Dave's that pesky line 10. There we go. Dave, if you can hear me, call back. We'll put you on. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky.
Oh, Tom. Yeah, sorry. I got cut off.
It's okay.
It was my phone. But that TPP passed. The ink wasn't even dry on the paper yet.
Well, the TPP hasn't passed yet. The TPA, the Trade Promotion Authority, Fast Track, has passed. But yeah,
okay, that passed. The ink wasn't dry on that paper when Security Safe here in Rochester announced 2 hours after it was passed that they were moving 350 jobs to Mexico.
Wow.
Now, if you and Louise would like to make your way to Rochester, I'll buy you both a big veggie burger, and I'll take you on a drive. Before you get three-quarters of the way through that veggie burger, we'll have went past 150,000 jobs that have been lost in this city.
Yeah. And anybody who wants to see what you're talking about, Corky, just take the train from New York to D.C. or vice versa. All along the Northeast Corridor, it used to be that factories would offload onto the trains the stuff that they manufactured. Now those factories are empty. They're, you know, tagged with graffiti. The windows are broken. Even the housing around them, which is good, high-quality housing, is all now vacant. And it's just a disaster. And why? Because of NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA. I mean, all of these trade agreements lead directly to this. And now we're making the same idiotic mistake again. It's amazing. 350 jobs shipped to Mexico 3 hours after the Senate voted for TPA. I'm Corky, thank you for the heads up. And hopefully one of these days we can take you up on that veggie burger offer. Thank you. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, with regard to the gentleman who offers up the view that slavery was America's first Social Security program, I would offer to him the following proposition. To he and any of his relatives who are unemployed or underemployed, I am more than happy to take up your cause, employ you in the same manner, provide you with the same kind of Social Security, as he refers to it, under the same conditions. I will be your benefactor. If it was such a great deal, I'm willing to extend it to you. I own part of a development company with my brother-in-law as a sort of side thing. And we are always looking for good workers. So if he contends that this is a great idea, I've got jobs for he and anyone who agrees with it.
So you'll build a slave quarters for him.
Absolutely. As he concedes, it's not going to be the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
I'll assure him of that.
Yeah.
And he can work for me without any remuneration, and I'll feed him, you know, provide basic health care enough to keep him working, you know.
Periodically whip him, tell him who he can and cannot have sex with or marry, take away his children as soon as they're born so that they can be sold. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that you could do, Steve, to, you know, with this.
Absolutely. Now, my field is race, class, and ethnic politics. I did my doctoral work in political science within that specific realm. And this is what tends to draw me to a lot of urban talk radio in addition to liberal progressive radio.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I think what you've seen here, because I've spent a lot of time since this incident, you know, listening to what African-Americans have to say on quote-unquote their own sort of programming.
Right.
And what you find is, you know, something that is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. That, you know, people who used to call into these shows, because I was a regular listener, you who would contend that, you know what, white people are out to annihilate us. That this is something that is, you know, some sinister plot, and they're just waiting for their opportunity. And so you've got this individual who actually also believes it from a different perspective,
right,
who then commits this atrocious act, which now you find as a response, you know, many African Americans are falling in line, and what I used to hear on these radio shows, that the ones who would offer up this idea that, yes, you know, white people are really, you know, sadistic and want to annihilate us, those people were marginalized by the vast majority of African Americans and said, well, you know, oh, that's just a kook calling in,
yeah,
you know, the fringe. Now, you know, that is given license to this belief system within the African American community. But of course, now, you know, it's lent itself to the idea, I've heard discussions about how we can arm ourselves as African-Americans, how we can, you know, be ready for that inevitable war that's coming between the races.
Yeah. Steve, I'm going to have to drop you right now, because I have not listened to any of those programs. I have been on a number of those programs. I've never heard anything like that. And this is beginning to sound to me like, you know, a good old boy from the South coming out and trying to rationalize. But, you know, who knows? We don't discuss at length anyway on this program other people's talk shows, particularly when I don't listen to them or I don't have an opportunity to. I don't own a car anymore. I used to listen to the radio in the car. Nina in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Nina, what's up?
You are, Tom, because you're the heart of this nation.
Well, thank you, Nina.
thank you for having this discussion. I hope it brings about some thoughts about unity, some understanding that we're just one race.
Yeah.
And we're all the human race, you know?
Yeah.
And President Obama, he should be a perfect example of how the blend of black and white manifest. You know, he's a pretty smart individual. He can think on both sides, hopefully sometimes trying to incorporate the good for all people. But I was having a discussion with a friend of mine last night, and he said something about how on Friday, when they both Biden and Obama attend the funeral services for some of the people that passed in South Carolina,
right,
that would be a perfect time to take them both out, because if so, Boehner would become the president.
Oh, God
forbid. I know it's a crazy thought, but it's a very scary thought.
Well, that thought occurred to me this morning as I was hearing the announcement that they're all going to be down there in South Carolina. I am sure that security will be like, 16 ways to Sunday, and I'm not, frankly, all that worried about it, although, that's what Kennedy's security detail said to him in November in 1963, and God forbid, Nan, God forbid. Thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before you.
Listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything goes summer, your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day, and we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service in about 5 minutes. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Amy in Madison, Wisconsin, listening on Free Speech TV on Roku. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Okay, I just think this is real interesting. Last week, the Supreme Court made a decision on a case. It was a Texas man claiming free speech to put a Confederate sign on his license. And the court said that's state property and not free speech.
Right. Well, they said that it's state property and therefore it's speech of the state. And if the state decides that it's not the kind of speech that the state wants, that's up to the state. It's, if the individual wants to speak, they don't need to get property of the state, the license plate, which you don't actually own. It's still the property of the state. But instead, you can put a bumper sticker on your car with a Confederate flag if you want. But, yeah, you're correct.
Oh, I thought it was better than that.
Pardon?
I thought it was better than that.
Yeah, no, it was the Sons of the Confederacy who filed the lawsuit. And they said, if you were a member of Sons of the Confederacy, you used to be able to get Sons of the Confederacy license plates. And from Texas, and the Supreme Court said, if Texas doesn't want to give those out anymore, they don't have to. So it was really about the speech of the state, and the state has the choice of what speech they want, So does it make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I just hope no one sues and gets it.
Well, we'll see. We'll see where it goes. I think the Supreme Court has spoken. Amy, thank you for the call. Genius Robert in Vail, Arizona. Hey, Genius, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Tom Hartman. I love your show.
Thank you.
I love your focus, and I love your hammering. I have actually 5 points. 5 points. Can you believe it?
Yeah, but, pick one, please.
I beg your pardon?
Pick one, please. We try to limit our callers to one essential point.
Well, the most important point is the fifth phrase in the preamble to the Constitution, and I would like to have that announced on every attempt at making law. The fifth phrase in the preamble to the Constitution is it says to promote the general welfare. They would really, really be exposed if they were to use that as a preface to any discussion.
Yeah, it's also in Article 1, Section 8.
I beg your pardon?
It's also in Article 1, Section 8, where it talks about the powers given to Congress, that they can raise taxes and spend money in order to promote the general welfare, which I would argue is, what Medicare is, what Medicaid is.
We need equality.
Pardon?
We need equality. Am I going to have to call you four more times to mention the other four that are very important?
We have 30 seconds. You can try one of them.
And engenders enough interest to give me a little bit of my freedom of speech thing to open up the eyes of people.
Well, I said we have 30 seconds. Now we're down to about 20.
Okay, here you go. The publicly funded elections, especially federal elections.
Right.
And then mandated voting. And then the other would be there's four points to governing, and they're all the four S's, I call them. Stability, sensitivity, security, and there's a fourth one.
And there's a fourth one. You and Rick Perry. Genius Robert, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Whoa!
Yeah, I'm hearing some. Let me call you right back if I can.
Thank you, Ellen. That was interesting. Ellen Ratner is going to be calling us right back. We're going to be checking in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. GoatsForTheOldGoat.com being Ellen Ratner's charity that takes place in South Sudan, which is melting down terribly right now. The South Sudanese really need help. And free-don.org, Don Siegelman, America's political prisoner. I just got a message from Don day before yesterday. I've got to write him a letter back. Ellen, let's try it again.
Well, there is actually, yes, we will try it again, and hopefully I can get here on the video as well. But so what's really interesting, I'm at the White House today, and the current governor of Alabama, not Don Siegelman, has actually called, he took down the flag of the Confederate flag flying over the state area. It wasn't the state house, it was the state area. So that is good. And my dear friend, Roger Wicker, who actually yesterday spoke at our South Sudan event at Congress, has called for the Mississippi flag, which has the stars and bars on it, to be in a museum. I'm actually going to South Sudan with Senator Wicker's sister on Saturday.
Wow.
So I'm very impressed with Senator Wicker, and I think he's doing exactly the right thing.
And he's a Republican.
And he is a Republican, as is the governor of and by the way, Roger Wicker is assured of being reelected. He is well-liked by everybody in Mississippi.
Yeah. I think what's happening, Ellen, is that the death cult of the South that shook for a decade or so after the Civil War, but then when Reconstruction got blown up, you know, just resumed their little routine. They just didn't have slavery, but they had Jim Crow. I think that death cult is now on its last legs. I think you're seeing people waking up from that cult.
I would hope so. Yeah. I would hope so. Okay, there's a lot of actually other news going on. One is that, as you know, the president today just gave a statement in the Roosevelt Room about hostage recovery activities. He has put out two different sort of executive orders. Well, it's actually one executive order, but then there's a policy directive on this. And they have a whole new agency which is going to deal with it, because what they're saying is that all these different agencies were giving families different messages. Well, it looks like, and again, this is unclear totally, it looks like a family will not be prosecuted for actually trying to pay for their hostage, trying to recover their person, their family member. However, it's still on the books because it is a law, and the president cannot unilaterally change laws.
Right.
So he made
Congress has to
on
do that.
And that's the big news that's happening right here at the White House as I speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, there's a few other interesting things that are going on today. Well, there's many interesting things going on. As you know, they say in the State Department, you don't have permanent friends, you don't have permanent enemies, you only have permanent interests. Well, even though at the same time it looks like there were two different breaches of the Office of Personnel Management, and I'll talk about that in a second, the United States government, through the State Department, has issued a U.S.-China climate cooperation. And it's interesting. This is the same time that we think that they've hacked into our systems. We're issuing a working group, a climate agreement with China. Now, right. Maybe we have to do that, but it is an interesting thing that's happening both.
Seems like a good idea. I mean, China is solarizing and wind powering faster than any other nation on Earth right now.
Well, that's part of the reason they want South Sudan and Central African Republic and Congo. They want their rare earths because they only have light rare earths, and that part of Africa has heavy rare earths, and in those windmills, et cetera, those use heavy and light rare earths.
Well, that's interesting.
Okay. Also going on today, the U.S. Department of Transportation is going to hold a public hearing. It's actually not going on today, but they announced it today. It's going to take place Thursday, July 2nd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and they are going to talk to Fiat Chrysler to determine whether they failed to remedy safety defects and issue required notices in 22 recalls.
Wow.
I mean, you cannot make this stuff up.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me talk about the hacking, because that's pretty interesting. So it looks like what happened is that there were two different hackings into our system, and the first one was personnel files, but the other one had to do with security clearances and who people have been talking to, who agents might have been, who CIA agents may have been, all of that kind of thing. It looks like there may be 18 million unique Social Security numbers. Now, at this event I had yesterday that Senator Wicker spoke at, I had many, because it was at Congress, many people came up to me and said, hey, do you know I got a letter? So they're slowly sending out letters to people saying that their information may have been hacked. Now, I don't know whether the government is going to consider changing Social Security numbers, but if I was the U.S. government, I think I would do that.
Yeah, yeah. Although it's going to be a huge job, a very large, very messy job to do that.
For sure. Okay, a couple other interesting items going on. As you know, members of Congress, or maybe you don't know, members of Congress actually went to see many of these families in detention. And now Jay Johnson has begun to issue issues on the family residential centers, saying that they're going to begin to look at how they're treating families, who they're picking up.
But you're talking about undocumented immigrants in the United States?
Right, okay. Exactly.
Yeah.
They're also saying that they're picking up a whole lot less people than they used to pick up.
Interesting.
They got into a lot of heat with Congress because of the way people are being treated. And the Republicans, who supposedly say, well, you know, we're family friendly, are getting a lot of heat from people in their districts because they're not so family friendly.
Right.
Right?
Well, they're billionaire friendly. If you happen to be a billionaire family, then.
If you're right, and you're not from Mexico and you're not picking fruit.
Right.
And as you know, the State Department still, as far as I know, particularly in Africa, but I think this also deals with Mexico, has not dealt with their problem with the computer system.
Yeah. It's amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. And we've been talking about a whole lot of different things today. And for those of you who are on hold, we're going to pick up that conversation at the bottom of the hour. So if you don't want to sit on hold for 30 minutes, you might want to call back. But either one is fine. One of the things we haven't discussed is international relations and specifically what's going on in Ukraine. And I wanted to I've seen so many headlines over the last few weeks. White House confirms plans to bring tanks, heavy weaponry to Russia's door. This is from Common Dreams. Senior Putin aide warns over Russia-U.S. relations. This is from the Financial Times. Russia-U.S. relations unlikely to improve. This is from the Associated Press. Dateline Baku. I wanted to get Stephen Cohen, Professor Stephen Cohen, back on, contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton, author his book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is just recently out in reissued in paperback. And, of course, he writes for The Nation. TheNation.com is the website. Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
Tom, before we end today, let's quarrel a little bit.
Okay.
Because it's not clear to me how people such as yourself, who are completely devoted to a progressive agenda in America, to social justice and all those things, cannot pay regular attention to international affairs. Because if we learned anything from the preceding Cold War, Cold War is really bad for progressive agendas.
You're right.
So the struggle, and I'm giving a sermon and I'll stop, but I'm a little agitated about it, not because of you, but for reasons we can talk about later.
Yeah.
That people who are really devoting their lives to a progressive electorate and agenda legislation in America seem to think it can exist apart from whatever happens abroad. Cold War is very bad for progressive agendas. In fact, Cold War can gut it politically, financially, and in various ways. So the link is there, and I think we have to keep an eye on both.
Right, and the U.S. and Russia are sliding back into a Cold War, and maybe with China as well.
Where do you want to begin today?
Well, let's begin at the beginning. What is the current situation in Ukraine? I've seen assertions in the news that we have proof positive that the Russians have soldiers there. I think one of the news networks did an expose where they were using GPS on pictures and things. On the other hand, well, you tell us. I shouldn't be the talking here.
I don't think that's the headline story today,
right.
But let me answer it briefly. Yes, of course, there are Russian soldiers in eastern Ukraine. There's a civil war in Ukraine between what's called the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine and the American-backed government in Kiev. Russia has come to the aid of the rebel army in eastern Ukraine. Yes. But there are also American troops in Ukraine. Officially, we've been told there are 300 American troops training Kiev's army, boots on the ground. But there are surely more than 300 militarily related American personnel in Ukraine. I don't know how many because the United States government won't tell us. But if you take it as a NATO figure, that is the United States plus, we know there are about an equal number of British and Canadian troops. So roughly speaking, a good guess would be, in uniform or not in uniform, there are probably about 1,500 at least American-led boots on the ground in Ukraine. If you were to ask me how many Russian soldiers there are on the ground in eastern Ukraine, I would guess at least that number, probably not more. So that's the situation. But can we go to today's headline?
Certainly, please.
Well, you and I start talking maybe 18 months ago when the Ukrainian crisis began. I said then that this is going to produce a new Cold War. It has. I said the new Cold War, because it's on Russia's borders in Ukraine, not in faraway Berlin, could be more dangerous than the last Cold War and could lead to a kind of Cuban Missile Crisis, eyeball to eyeball, who's going to blink confrontation between Russia and the United States, the United States and NATO.
You do.
All right. That trajectory, that fateful, deplorable trajectory has unfolded almost monthly during the 14 months or so you and I have talked. Yesterday, the new American Secretary of Defense announced that the Pentagon and NATO are going to move a considerable amount of heavy military equipment to countries right plunk on Russia's borders, particularly the three Baltic countries, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, but also to several others not far away, including, above all, Poland. All right. Your folks should stop and think. The newspapers say this is the first time this has happened since the end of the Cold War. No. This is the first time this has ever happened in history. American forces had never been on Russia's borders. It's true that during the Russian Revolution and Civil War in 1918, 1919, there was a small American expeditionary force in Russia. That doesn't count. My uncle, my late uncle, actually was among those soldiers, and he described it to me, and it didn't amount to much. This is serious. So what has happened as of right now, as Tom, as you and I talk, though you're not going to hear this from the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the mainstream broadcast media, is that the Cold War, which has been unfolding and institutionalized, both in misinformation and sanctions, economic sanctions, the movement of NATO troops around Russia's borders, in Russia's, near Russia's shores, in the Black Sea, the Baltic Sea, in the air, and Russia is doing tit for tat, doing the same thing. But what happened yesterday with this official announcement of the movement of this American NATO equipment is that the Cold War has been escalated in the direction of a hot war with Russia. For this reason, this is an extremely provocative step by Washington, moving this equipment there. Russia has made it clear that it will respond. It must respond because there's a politics in Moscow. Putin has to do something. He can't be wimp-like about this. Whatever he does won't be good. But whatever he does, then Obama or whoever's running the show in Washington, we don't know, will have to respond to that. So now we have a militarized tit-for-tat that is escalating the Cold War in the direction of hot war. And the Cuban Missile Crisis type of fateful moment, eyeball to eyeball, that I worried about 14 months ago, is probably a month or two away. And that's what, as for what's going on in Ukraine, we need to talk about. But note this, that all the information flowing out of the main capitals in the West about this NATO and American troop movement never mentions Ukraine any longer. It's all about some alleged Russian threat to the three small Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and there is none whatsoever. This is pure misinformation, disinformation, propaganda in the sense that it isn't true, and that there are people in the main capitals, Washington, NATO headquarters in Brussels, in Kiev, in Berlin, in Warsaw, who actually want to escalate militarily this crisis. And I've begun to worry, though this is my nightmare and not my certain analysis, that some of these people actually want a military showdown.
Amazing. We'll be, Professor Stephen Cohen is with us, contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton, the author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is just out in paperback. TheNation.com is the website. We'll be right back with Professor Cohen.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And to read Professor Cohen's writings, check out TheNation.com. And welcome back. Professor Cohen, you said in the next month or two, what causes you to come up with that timeline?
Well, there, according to Ash Carter, the American Secretary of Defense, who made this announcement yesterday, they're moving the equipment now. Some of the equipment does not have to be shipped from the United States because it's stored in Germany. So one assumes that this American equipment will be on Russia's borders within, 2 weeks.
Are we talking tanks, missile launchers, what?
Keep going. Make your inventory. Everything. Wow. Bear in mind what this is. I mean, I'm sorry to kind of make these headlines that I'm giving you so wordy, but none of this appears in the American press. Nobody's paying any attention.
Right.
What this is another step of NATO expansion toward Russia, which began 20 years ago under Clinton and brought in all these countries on Russia's borders, but did not arm them with NATO military power. That's what they're doing now. But with it comes what we call benign missile defense installations. Now, the Russians, we say this is just a defensive system. which is going to be put in Romania and Bulgaria and Poland. Maybe now they'll want to put it in the Baltics. This missile defense system, when it reaches its fourth or fifth stage of development, I'm not sure which, according to Russians and some scientists at MIT, will have the capacity to be an offensive system. That is, it could fire missiles at Russia's retaliatory sites within Russia. So imagine what that's meant, whether we like it or not. What's prevented nuclear war ever since the atomic age or nuclear age began 40 years ago is the knowledge on both sides in Moscow and Washington that if one attacks the other, the one who attacked will be destroyed because the other can retaliate. The Russians are saying that these NATO missile defense systems, which are really American, will have the capacity to wipe out Russia's capacity to retaliate and therefore create in the West a first strike nuclear doctrine. This is reckless. I mean, mutual assured destruction is an awful concept. Reagan hated it. Gorbachev hated it. So they decided to abolish nuclear weapons. But it kept the nuclear peace. What's going to happen if all this equipment is plunked on Russia's borders? What will Russia do? We don't want to go in this direction. And by the way, this from an American president who said his mission was to abolish nuclear weapons. All he's done is spur a new nuclear arms race, which is underway both in the United States and in Russia.
Right. We are upgrading very rapidly our nuclear weapons capability. In fact,
well, they have a benign word for it. They call it modernization.
Right.
Putin says, well, we're modernizing too. And when you get two modernizations, that adds up to a nuclear arms race, a renewed one.
Right.
Because these are more lethal, more precise. It's no longer the number you have in some ways. It's their capacity for destruction and precision.
Right. And the introduction of these battlefield nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, this is...
Exactly.
This is really,
the fact that both sides are talking about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Openly. We'll be right back with Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU in Princeton, author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. You can read about it at thenation.com. Stick around. So last week, the 23rd, the U.S. Department of Defense announced on Tuesday it's indeed planning to bring tanks and other heavy weaponry to Russia's doorstep, this to Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland. Meanwhile, Sergei Ivanov writing, relations between Russia and the United States unlikely to improve until the crisis in Ukraine is settled. Nonetheless, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's recent visit to Russia's Sochi was a positive episode, this 21 June. With us, Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU in Princeton, and author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, thenation.com. Professor Cohen, you were just saying that our moving heavy equipment into these Baltic states, I think they're called, from Estonia down to Poland, is provocative to Russia. And within a month or so, this could lead to some sort of an outbreak or some sort of serious problem. What do we do about this, A? And B, what are your thoughts on on Secretary of State Kerry's recent trip to Russia? Did anything positive come out of that?
This is an absolutely essential question you just raised. And the answer tells you a lot. At the end of May, Secretary of State Kerry went to Sochi in Russia and met for 4 hours, focus on that, 4 hours with President Putin of Russia. This was astonishing in many ways because the official policy of the Obama administration is, and I quote, to isolate Russia.
Right.
And yet there is Obama Secretary of State sitting there for 4 hours on videotape, affably having all sorts of discussions with Putin. When it was over, it was made clear, both by Putin and by Kerry, that the Obama administration had changed its mind and was now going to support what's called the Minsk Accords, which is a program for negotiating peacefully the civil war in Ukraine. Kerry left Sochi, and a day later, a person very close to Vice President Biden told the New York Times they didn't know what Kerry was doing in Sochi. He shouldn't have been there. It was counterproductive. So what you got was what I've told you all along, that there is a split between what I call the war party that thinks you can resolve this crisis by military means and a diplomacy party that thinks it should be negotiated. Kerry had become, in Sochi, the representative of the diplomacy party. He left Sochi and he was gutted by the administration. And the answer to Kerry we now see with the movement by the Pentagon of these American weapons to Russia's borders, because that's antithetical to negotiation. So the peace party, the diplomacy party, has taken a terrible blow. Meanwhile, the civil war, the crisis in Ukraine, goes from bad to worse. The American-backed regime in Kiev is in full meltdown, politically, financially. This neo-fascist battalion called Right Sector has threatened within days to march on Kiev and overthrow the Ukrainian president, Poroshenko, if he doesn't launch a new war against the Russian-backed rebels in Ukraine. So there is no good news. And the party that wants a military showdown with Russia, or at a minimum thinks that this can be solved by escalating the military dimension of the Cold War, is winning on a weekly basis. There is no opposition to it. Now, if you've got 2 minutes left, we might want to ask why there's no opposition to it.
Please.
All right. You got to strap yourself in for this now. If you look at everybody who's declared as a presidential candidate, Republican, Democratic, and God, I don't know, what do we got now? I've lost
15 of them or so, yeah, 20.
Every one of them. Only one has said publicly that the policy toward Putin's Russia is crazy and wrong. Only one has said Putin is doing nothing more than defending in a statesmanlike and rational way Russia's legitimate national interest, and that Putin should be a national security partner for the United States. And now is where you tighten your seatbelt. That one and only presidential candidate is Donald Trump.
Right.
All right. What does that tell you? Here's what it tells me. All the other candidates, in addition to running against each other, are running against Putin. Hillary Clinton's running against Putin. Jeb Bush is running against Putin. They're all running against Putin. But we know that there are two candidates whose domestic thinking and foreign policy thinking, to the extent to which it exists, actually does not favor this American policy. There's one in the Republican Party, that's Rand Paul. We know what he thinks about this American overreach, but he doesn't say. The one in the Democratic Party is Senator Sanders, because his program could never be implemented if this Cold War continues to escalate in this military direction. So therefore, I think we have to ask ourselves, why have not Rand Paul and Senator Sanders spoken out and said what they think about this American policy that's leading in a direction that's completely incompatible with their own domestic agendas? Is it fear? Do they think that American voters won't understand and listen? I think they will. So from my point of view, what we need as a nation is for Senator Paul and Senator Sanders to tell us where they stand on this greatest international crisis of our time.
You said that there's a schism within the administration.
Right.
John Kerry did not go to Sochi without the permission of the president, did he? I mean, isn't the president taking all of these?
I'm the Russia guy. You're the American guy, Tom. Can an American Secretary of State initiate his or her own foreign policy with the American president saying either, yes, go do this, I support you, or if you think this is a good idea, go try, but it's on you? I don't know.
Yeah.
All I know is that the Vice President Biden has been mandated by the President Obama to run this Ukrainian operation. And Obama's people attacked Kerry. And then, of course, Kerry broke his leg, and we haven't seen him since.
Right, right. Remarkable, remarkable.
Yeah,
Professor Cohen, thank you so much for being with us today. And Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. Check out his book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, thenation.com. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we'll be back with Anything Goes Summer right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Shano tells me that the Trade Promotion Authority, a.k.a. Fast Track, actually, that has already been passed. This will be the Trade Adjustment Authority, a.k.a. No? Oh, the vote is... Thank you. Okay. You're talking the Senate. I was thinking the House because I just saw the headline over at Huffington Post about how Nancy Pelosi says, I'm going to vote for this thing. You know, let's go along with it. The Trade Promotion Authority Fast Track is going to be voted on. As predicted, I predicted this at the beginning of the show. I said they're going to do it after 5 o'clock so it doesn't hit the evening news cycle. The vote is scheduled for 5:30 this afternoon in the Senate. Last chance to call your senators. 202-225-3121 is the number for the United States Senate. For the Capitol switchboard. And then you just ask for your senator, and if you're not sure who it is, just tell them what state you live in, and they'll tell you who your senators are. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'm having a real hard time here today. I hope you can help me out.
Okay.
In the events of yesterday, we had this tsunami, this tidal wave against the Confederate battle flag, and primarily its roots in slavery and an economic system based on slavery.
Right.
On the same day, we have a Senate vote pushing through the trade, the TPP, that is going to give a blind eye, a pass to Malaysia, who has just been reported the lowest tier of the human trafficking report against modern slavery, for their use of slave labor, primarily in electronics assembly, by the largest multinational corporations out there. American workers are going to be in direct competition with slaves.
Right.
How is this possible?
This is what happens when the billionaires and the transnational corporations take over the world, Dave. And that's what they're doing right in front of us. Just, you know, in plain sight.
The disconnect is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
For something, slavery in this country 150 years ago, yet we have modern day slavery. And China is not much better.
Yeah. And Vietnam, you know, it's illegal to form a trade union in Vietnam, and the minimum wage is 56 cents an hour. And on it goes. I mean, yeah, I absolutely agree. And at some point,
we're enforcing it.
Yeah, and at some point, the American people are going to say no. I mean, it's how much more of the destruction of the industrial base of the United States do we need before we say no? I think we're very close to that, and I think that this is going to be one of the central issues in the next election. And I think with this that President Obama has damaged his legacy in ways that he can't imagine. That he is going to, you know, we are all going to look back on this and say, boy, was that was a horrible mistake, a terrible time. We should have been moving in the exact opposite direction.
President Obama just makes it more ironic.
Yeah.
I can't comprehend it.
Yeah, I can't either, frankly. I can't either. I'd love to blame it all on Michael Froman. I don't think I can, though. Dave, thank you for the call. James in Oak Harbor, Washington. God bless Robert E. Lee. Really?
Really?
You want to defend slavery?
Hi, Dr. Hartman.
Here is this is called the Cornerstone Speech. This is the Vice President of the Confederacy, March 21st, 1861, just a week or so before hostilities commenced. Alexander Stevens in Savannah, Georgia said, and I quote, this was the Vice President of the Confederacies, those ideas of the U.S. Constitution were fundamentally wrong. They rested upon the assumption of the equality of the races. This was an error. It was a sandy foundation, and the government built upon it fell when the storm came and the wind blew. Our new Confederate government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great philosophical, physical, philosophical, and moral truth. You're calling to defend that?
Not at all. I'm calling to defend Robert E. Lee.
Well, Robert E. Lee, was the general who...
Civil War.
I beg your pardon?
You going to talk over me?
Yeah, go ahead.
He ended the Civil War. He saved 20,000 lives.
He started the Civil War.
What?
He helped start the Civil War. He didn't end the Civil War. He lost the Civil War. There's a difference.
Well, he ended the Civil War, and he disobeyed his president of the South and surrendered and ended the Civil War, and he went on to work for Reconstruction. He was a president of a college. He believed in free college for Negroes. He was a great man. I don't know why you keep trashing him.
Because he was a traitor. He led, the Constitution defines treason as leading an armed rebellion against the United States. And that's exactly what Robert E. Lee did. The man was a traitor. James, thank you for the call. Thomas in Stonewall, North Carolina. Hey, Thomas, what's up? Thomas, can you hear me?
My name's Thomas, but I'm in Stonewall, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Well, tell me where you are, and let's talk.
Oh, I'm in Sparta, Tennessee, Tom. You're one of my favorite folks on television.
Well,
but I want to say one thing. I'm a Southerner. My family never believed in slavery. I'm a liberal, voted for Obama twice, support Bernie Sanders. But there's one thing that bothers me about all this. Them same Union soldiers that came through the South turned right around with their dog soldiers, went out and finished annihilating the Indians. And I think you people ought to set the South a good example by taking the faces off of Mount Rushmore and giving it back to the Lakotas. That'd make the South feel a lot better about tearing down our monuments.
Yeah. You know, I don't disagree with you, Thomas. I don't think tearing down Mount Rushmore is the answer, but that land was sacred land to the Lakota. It still is sacred land to the Lakota. And the first genocide, the first race-based war in the United States was the war against Native Americans, and it continues to this day, in my opinion. And, in fact, the most recent example is what John McCain and Jeff Flake did by giving the sacred land of the San Carlos Apache tribe to a subsidiary of Rio Tinto, an Australian mining company, so that they can create a giant copper mine and dig a mile square hole in the ground that under the sacred land that's been used for 10,000 years. You're absolutely right, Thomas. Thank you for the call, Ron in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Hey, Ron, what's up? Ron, watching Free Speech TV in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. On line two, you can check that out, Danielle. Kenyatta in Redlands, California. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the long, hot summer that it looks like we're about to face. I am a member of a group of black businessmen in the Los Angeles area. And subsequent to the mass shooting in South Carolina recently, I can tell you that there are a significant number of black people in this country that have just about had it with singing songs and marching. And I'm very concerned how this is going to turn out. I can tell you that the backlash against Barack Obama, which I was concerned with when he was elected, is going to really reach a fever pitch this summer. You know, we've had, the NAACP lady. It seems like almost every day there's something that some type of antagonism directed towards black people, if not outright murder. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on where this is going to go.
Well, I think that this has been going on all along, and that the advent of ubiquitous cameras in cell phones has now, for the first time in history, actually, in the history of this country, allowed white people who are essentially clueless and have no contact with black people and don't have any friends who, you know, can tell them what's going on in the African-American community or experience, as it were, to realize how bad it is, you know, particularly with regard to police. And I'm actually optimistic. I think that this is a wake-up moment for white America. Now, I'm a white guy, and that's the perspective I'm looking at it from. I'm hearing white people saying things that I didn't, you know, I wasn't hearing them say 10 and 20 years ago about the horrors that are inflicted on black people routinely, daily, you know, from small insults to as you point out, murder by the police. Is there any, you know, on your end, am I making sense, Kenyatta?
Yeah, you are, and you always tend to be an optimist, and I love that about you. But I just don't. I think the trajectory, I think the inertia that this is having. Fox News referred to President Obama as the rapper in chief because he used the word
the N word.
I'm not going to say it on the air, but he used the word. And the reality is that word. In fact, I posted a piece today on the community site regarding this word. This word is ubiquitous.
Sure.
And it's had a staying power in the American lexicon, unlike any other racial slur. So there's a certain disingenuousness, as far as I'm concerned, about this. I find it hard to believe that, and I've traveled all over this country, but I find it hard to believe that this is such news to white people, even given the disruptive technology. Because if on the one hand, you say, well, we just can't say the word N-word, but if you look at movies, if you look at anything in popular culture, that word's everywhere. But
sure,
you don't hear racial slurs like stick and wop and mick and blah, blah, blah. You don't hear those.
Right. Yeah. Because those are mostly white people, right? I get it. But Kenyatta, let me tell you, you know, as a white guy who lives in a largely white culture and a largely white community, I'm serious. I this isn't just an opinion. I'm seeing this. White people are waking up to the reality of at least part of the experience of black people in this country. I think it's a good thing. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Man, I hope that we can all have a little patience with each other and try and work through this, because I think this is a turning point in American history. A good one. Welcome back. Ron in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Hey, man, why aren't you running for president?
Because I'd make a lousy president. I'm a pretty good talk show host and author.
You'd make a great president because you know, make the facts. And a lot of people, especially down here in the South, they don't want to hear the facts. You know?
Yeah.
I debate with people every day about, you know, the Southern Confederates being traitors and this and that. And, I'm just crazy. And, you know, I just don't know how to deprogram them. My parents being mainly the ones. But I agree with a lot of things you say, especially this trade agreement, man. It proves that how Obama just finally got in their pocket. They got him in his pockets, you know, and trying to get their agenda.
Yeah. The question is, when did it happen? I don't know
when
the
it
answer.
Happened. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe he did stand up to him on the pipeline issue, you know. I thought he did anyway, maybe.
Well, we'll see. I mean, the administration still has not made a decision about Keystone XL.
Right.
You know, if he allows the Keystone XL pipeline to continue along with this trade agreement, he's going to have, I think, a very mixed legacy in the minds of many Americans.
You're right. I mean, it's obvious that he finally caved into him, maybe, or maybe he was there all the time. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess
we'll see.
It'd be interesting to find out, huh?
We will see. Ron, thanks a lot for the call. And, spot on. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I was watching your friend Coann talk about Ukraine. People have a tendency to forget that a lot of this started when the U.S. oil companies went over there and wanted to start fracking.
Yeah, Chevron.
And, yes, and they also forget that it's really not a U.S. company anymore. It has international partners. And when you start going into these countries and making a mess, and they have already seen it, I don't know if you ever got to see Fracking Hell, the big picture about fracking. It had a segment on Poland and how they tried to stop this and they lost. And the people in Ukraine saw that, and they didn't want fracking. So we went in and we threw over the Russian guy, the Russian-based guy, and put in our own more or less more European government in Ukraine.
Right.
And they forget, too, that with that large natural gas field off the coast of the Arabian Peninsula, they wanted to run that pipeline across Syria. Syria is a trade partner of Russia. They said no. And so you have ISIS show up in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood followed by ISIS. And now you also have ISIS in control of the oil wells in Iraq. And until they can get Iraq under control and get Syria under control, they can't run that pipeline up there.
Right.
And so you have two groups who want war with Russia. One is the oil companies, and the other one is the military suppliers. Because if you don't have a war, you don't make money off of selling stuff to the government.
Right.
And people don't, you know, we don't need a war with Russia.
When you read these leaked Saudi cables, too, you get it that Saudi Arabia has been, if these cables are true, and the Saudis are asserting that they're not, but if they are true, that the Saudis have been doing everything they can, or much of what they can, to cripple the Sunni-led new government in Iraq that we helped bring into place. And
that's true. And you've got to remember that anywhere that you can push the Muslim religion, then behind it comes political power. And Russia has had a problem with millions of illegal Muslim refugees crossing their border.
Right.
And as you push them out...
Within their contiguous, you know, like Chechnya, for example, within contiguous countries as well. And there's a lot of Muslims in Russia. Norma, thank you for the call. I think you've nailed it. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Kamaru in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Kamaru, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
I just wanted to say this. I was watching Free Speech TV last night, and Reverend Barber, the president of the North Carolina NAACP, was on, and with some other politicians, all white, who had advocated for bringing down the flag.
Right.
But when Reverend Barber, when he brought up the fact that what really needs to happen is for these states that are talking about bringing down that Confederate flag, what they really should be doing is accepting Medicaid, the expansion of Medicaid, raising the minimum wage, and stop the
voter suppression.
Suppression of black voters.
Yeah.
All of them, to a person, said they weren't ready to do that.
Right.
So this whole bringing down the flag thing is really just symbolic. It doesn't really, well, if given the choice of bringing down the Confederate flag or having those policies being pushed, I would much rather leave the flag up and have those policies be pushed, because that would be substantive. This other stuff is just symbolic, and in the end, it's not going to do much at all.
I think you could build a strong case, Kamaru, that for what you're saying, basically the white Southern power structure, which has been actively oppressing people of color since before the founding of this country, is not going to give up on continuing to do that. This is the Republican Party's official strategy. Lee Atwater laid it out in 1981. Richard Nixon started it in 72. Reagan ran on it and won. George Bush, absolutely. And that they're just going to throw a bone. You know, here, we'll take down the flags, but don't ask us to raise the minimum wage. Don't ask us to stop voting suppression. Don't ask us to take Medicaid expansion. But that said, it is a step, and it is a first step, and I would never underestimate the power of symbology. I mean, if I stood in front of the U.S. Capitol with a Nazi flag and did the Sieg Heil, that's just a gesture, right? It's just a symbol. But it has significant meaning and consequence, or burning a flag or whatever it may be. I mean, you know, the symbols are... symbols are very, very powerful, and I think...
Okay, can I...
Go for it.
Can I give you a concrete example of the same kind of thing?
Sure.
Okay. When schools were desegregated, it actually, if you consider the aggregate, it actually hurt black people much more than it helped.
Because
most of the administrators who were black and ran highly efficient schools, because I know I'm a product of them. Those people lost their jobs.
Mm.
And so the administrators, the schools are resegregating now, and the administrators, even the black ones, who are over those schools today, are horrible. And so...
Well, they're underpaid, they're understaffed, they're under-resourced.
But, okay, Tom, I teach in an inner-city school,
mm-hmm.
and the administrators are adequately paid, they're adequately staffed, but they don't make sure that the schools are adequately staffed.
I see.
And these are black people.
Right.
So now, if those black administrators who lost their jobs had been there to train other black administrators, we would never have this situation.
But what you're talking about, Kamaru, is maintaining apartheid, essentially, in the United States.
That's what's happening. No. I'm not saying that we should not have done that. What I'm saying is that those people who were far more qualified, for example, the principal in a lot of the schools that we had were PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
And the principals in school didn't have master's degrees.
Yeah.
So but those were the people who lost their jobs and became assistants. So that had a devastating effect on us, and I can see the product of that right now.
You're talking about the 60s and so-called forced busing?
Yes. Even the 50s, Tom.
Yeah.
This started in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Yeah. I'm not old enough to remember the 50s, although I lived through them, but I do remember the 60s quite vividly.
Well, I was in school in the 50s, and all of my teachers that I had were excellent.
Yeah.
And the principals ran the school like a school should be ran.
Yeah.
So getting back to... this idea of this symbolic taking down of the flag, it is far better to have something substantive rather than symbolic.
Right. So let's be working on policy beyond the simple policy of just taking down a flag. That makes so much sense, Kamaru. Thank you so much for the call, and thank you for helping educate me. I appreciate it. Thank you so much to everybody who's called in today, to you for watching or listening to the program. And, you know, in, what, 2.5 hours, around 5:30 this afternoon, they're going to vote on trade promotion authority in the Senate, and then it's going to go to the House for the trade adjustment authority, and Nancy Pelosi says she's going to vote for it, so it looks like this thing is going to go through. So the next battle will be the TPP itself, as they try to ram that down our throats. Don't forget, it begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.